Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson, of course, and it is March 2nd, 2017. Culture. You know, we talk about the eight forms of capital, and cultural capital is the one we kind of give a little, kind of we throw our hands up, shrug our shoulders in the book Prosper, because we say it's the one that is the hardest to influence. It takes lifetimes. We often say that if you don't like the culture you're in, maybe you should consider moving to one that you like, because that is easier by far. But today we're going to be talking with somebody who actively seeks to create culture, is seeking to modify it, has said, I can look at this, I can look at how indigenous cultures have done this, I can look at how we're doing it, I can see some big gaps in how we're going about this. So we're actually very excitingly talking with somebody I happen to know very well, Mark Morey. He's the person who started the Vermont Wilderness School that you've heard me talk about, that my kids went to, which some of you would have thought, oh, that sounds great. Kids in the woods, they learned how to make rope with their hands and fashion debris shelters. Those were the activities. But what was running under that, just stealthily and ingeniously, that created the most beautiful children, my own and others that I've seen, was a new cultural blueprint, which is actually sort of an old cultural blueprint. There are ways that humans are designed to be. It's in our DNA. And a lot of our current culture right now runs across that. The number of people who come to our seminars or who interact with us at the website who say, I hate my job. I am not fulfilled. I wish I was leading a different life. How can you be this unfulfilled? This is peak easiness for humans. It's never been easier to live, work, get across the world. I can click a couple buttons and be in Hong Kong tomorrow if I want. It's amazing. And yet, the levels of dissatisfaction are off the charts. So with that, Mark, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Chris. Yeah, it's good to talk with you about this. It's a topic that lies in the unseen.
In the unseen, yeah.
Yeah, and maybe that's why I've become a specialist in this, if you could call that. You know, as I think maybe because of some of my twisted upbringing, I've learned to bring the invisible to the visible. You know, to make the unknown known and translate that. So sometimes that's called being an artist. Maybe it's called being a magician. Mm-hmm. But it tends to be a lifelong skill, I guess I have. And really my interest is in trying to find the code underneath dissatisfaction. Because I think that it's not part of our human history where we're at today. I think we're in a bit of an experiment.
Well, let's talk about that experiment for a bit. Is it... you also go out and carefully observe where we are, how humans seem to be relating their experience of being alive. Is it unfair for me to sort of characterize that there's a deep dissatisfaction running? So by the statistics, I've heard it said that in the United States at least, but this is true elsewhere, that we are the most over-medicated, overweight, unhappy, unfulfilled. When we take surveys, we report being isolated. We've never been more connected or more alone at the same time. Is this fair?
Yeah, I'd agree with all that. And I would say I was learning about that 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. So it's not even like the 2000s are emerging. This is, goes way back. And I think probably the really upset people who were wanting to create cultural revolution in the 60s and 70s felt that even from the mechanisms of the 50s and those kinds of McCarthy era things. But yeah, I remember reading a book called, forget what it's called, but it was about studying the pharmaceutical industry and how the largest emerging market was the 0 to 3 year old range. Hmm. How disturbing is that? Mm-hmm. Or just how children can recognize 200 or 300 logos from corporations before they can identify 5 or 6 species outside. Mm-hmm. So we are in some deep programming that we don't even realize how far in we are. That can explain some dissatisfaction. And the overweight obesity thing is disturbing too, because, you know, that has all these psychological effects, you know, besides being incapable. Mm. I you know, one of the sayings I like to say is that my work is to comfort the disturbed and disturb the comfortable. And yeah. So this image that we're raising the most unhealthy, softest, weakest children that probably humanity's ever seen in this country. Mm-hmm. They're just incapable, unresilient, low on the grit scale. I mean, the fact that we talk about grit now, there's books on grit.
Really?
Books on perseverance. You know, and
I only made it to page 3.
Yeah, I didn't have that will to get through it. There's this guy over in Scotland who grew up on an island, and I met him because I was running one of these courses on creating culture again and looking at the blueprint of how human beings have done this. So I brought that work to Europe, and then specifically Scotland, where my ancestors are from, which is a whole story. And I coached the local people that you want to go and look for people who are like old stock cultural people, who are a little bit pushed off to the margin, the old fishing village people whose culture is dying away. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they found one and they brought him to the Art of Mentoring. And this guy was archaic. He had a charisma and a power to him that was rough as the North Atlantic. That's what it felt like. He was not rude, but in your face and just demonstrably passionate. And he told us this long story about mentoring, because that's what the course is called, The Art of Mentoring. He says, I thought a lot about this. You know, why is it called The Art of Mentoring? Why do we even need a word called mentoring? Mm-hmm. When I grew up, there was no word called mentoring. I grew up in a village where people depended on each other or we died. Yeah. So, you know, you had to learn how to row a boat, and, you know, people took you under their wing because that young guy was going to be catching fish for you later when you were old. And that's the way the world worked at that time. So you'd find somebody to apprentice under and they'd take you under their wing and go out fishing. You come back, and this was a village where you literally walked from the dock back home. Mm-hmm. No cars. And you passed your fish out to the people on the way back home. Fresh fish. Here it is. Here's the catch of the day. And you did it again the next morning. And you got your needs met from the other people. Like fairy tale level. Mm-hmm. And then he goes on to tell the story of this. His mentor was the best rower in the village because he had no legs.
No legs.
Yeah. Mm. He had no legs, and that he was had to use his arms, right, for everything, and he was really sensitive with how he rowed his boat. You know, so he was a master of the two-arm rowing, and he was so intense with me when I was rowing my boat. No, little left, little to the right, use the other one, no this one, no that one. And he said, I love that man for the integrity that he had and the purpose that he had and how he was able to express that to another person. That he was useful in that environment, and everybody knew that. And then he goes on to talk about how one day there was these rough seas and he got tossed overboard. And because he didn't have legs, he couldn't keep himself up in the water. And he scratched his fingernails down the side of the boat, and they saw the claw marks on the wood, and they dragged him ashore later on, you know, and the village wept and came together and cried. And he just was like, screaming at us, like with this kind of passion, mm-hmm. that, you know, we have a life to live with each other, you know, no matter who we are. And he just, you could really feel the edge of life and death that he lived on, that he wouldn't trade it for the world. But he was sad to see people letting those things go, becoming isolated, having to learn about the word mentoring, having had to learn about the word connection, because it's gone.
Right.
So that was a lot of what his fury was about, was both telling like how it was and mourning that it was going right before his eyes.
Yeah, no, I can relate to that. And, you know, it's said that if you learn a second language before the age of 13, roughly, you can pick it up fairly accentless. But after that, you're always going to have an accent. You know, I think about my grandmother who came to this country when she was 18 from Finland. I mean, my goodness, she... You know, hard to understand her, you know, when she was 70, right? Still had that thick Finnish accent, right? So perhaps some of the mourning that this gentleman is experiencing is that if we think we're going to just suddenly develop mentoring and connection later because it seems like a good idea. Maybe if we haven't actually sort of natively learned that and absorbed that by the time we're 13, we'll speak it, but we're always going to kind of have that accent. Like his deep knowing of that might be something I don't experience because I'm too old for that in essence. So, I mean, this is in large measure why you started the Vermont Wilderness School and said, we got to start with the kids. We got to start there.
Yeah. The key is regenerative. If we want to go back to, I like that you're naming that because I think one of the issues, I was just talking to John Young about this the other day, that when people get involved in nature connection and cultural mentoring, from where they're standing, they think they know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. They think they know what they're learning about. But the gap is so wide. I guess you could maybe use a metaphor of like a martial arts studio where you have the grand master and the new student. And the new student pretty much knows like he's hot shit.
You know? Best in class.
And he's been there a year. And he pretty much knows everything he needs to know. And I think we've seen that in other cases. But culture is like that too. And if we don't know what we don't know, the gap is tremendous from how our ancestors lived and what our potential is in being human.
Well, let's talk about then, again, before we narrow in this wider stuff. You know, I was interviewing Sebastian Younger, and he wrote the book The Perfect Storm, and he had another one out called Tribe. And Tribe was about, he was an embedded war correspondent, you know, original hard ass, sort of like never went to the military himself, but spent more time in hot action frontline stuff reporting about it. That kind of guy. He spent a lot of time in Afghanistan, did all the unit embedding, and then came back and was disturbed enough by the statistic of 22 veterans a day committing suicide that he said, wow, I have to understand this. So he went in with an idea. He said, I went in with a complete idea. And the idea was that I'm going to discover that these people have PTSD. They saw like friends being blown apart, and then there was no support system for them, and they get home, and so they kill themselves. And he said what shocked him was that half, 11 of those people who were committing suicide each day were veterans, hadn't ever seen action at all. Mm. So now he's curious. He's like, oh, now I got to start digging. And the result, to get to the end of this, was he found that these people were describing that when they were over-embedded in their units, even if they didn't see action, there was a sense of camaraderie, belonging, cohesion that was important. And then their tour's up, and they get dropped off at the, you know, you literally get off an airplane and you're at the Paramus Airport or Newark or San Jose, and that's it. Like, there's no welcoming committee. There's nobody saying, let us help you understand what that experience was. You're just tossed back into a culture that is so vacant of meaning that some people come back to that and say, I'd rather not even be here at all. How damning of an indictment of our culture is that?
Yeah. My partner, Krista, works with veterans who are right on the edge, and she's done a lot of work. Her father was a combat veteran in Vietnam. And she gives me statistics like it costs like $1 million to create a combat warrior. Mm-hmm. $1 million of training and expenses and tools and all this. And what they spend after they leave the military is zero.
Yeah,
it's not 10,000 per guy. It's not 100,000. It's zero.
Well, no, the ribbons that we tie around our trees to show our support for the troops, those cost like, what, 25 cents?
But the veterans don't get
that. Oh, they don't get that. You're right. So it's still zero.
The social capital doesn't make it.
I have the bumper sticker. Have I not done enough?
Yeah, so I hear you. So even though we're talking about, obviously, the layered complexity of being in the military and what the military is doing, mm-hmm. there's this aspect of bonding that takes place, these unconscious community cultural things. Or maybe it is conscious. I'm sure they're pretty intentional psychologically about what makes people trust each other. You know, mm-hmm. stripping identity, mm-hmm. right? And the having codes and values and chants and songs and duress with each other. That's all stuff that I've done with kids.
No. I totally get it. So this is all just by way of painting, saying, look, here's some data that suggests, you know, whether it's veteran suicides or obesity or psychoactive drug use, that collectively say, if we were Martians tasked with coming down and deciding whether we were going to rebuild the culture exactly as is, or maybe tweak it, we might come down and say, this isn't ideal. We could fix a few things here. So there's plenty of evidence. That's the first thing I want people to sort of come away with, is that sense of, we don't have to be this way, but we've fallen into this way because we haven't consciously chosen this. This is why culture is the hardest thing to talk about. It's like fish to a water. You're surrounded by it. As Daniel Quinn said, Mother Culture whispers to us so seductively we can't even hear it, right? So we're surrounded by it, but then we get these pieces of data that say, ooh, maybe we could do something better. So let's flip this entirely around. One thing I was really taken by a long time ago, it stuck with me, was you describing what you discovered and what is known about going to how indigenous cultures, whether these are Kung Bushmen or Inuits or Aborigines, totally disparate, different people, different environments, different races, all sort of triangulating and saying, no, no, we're all humans, and here's the human blueprint. If we were going to be these Martians to rebuild this, what are those common building blocks that the indigenous people seem to have had that maybe we don't?
Yeah, that's a huge subject. And we can include our ancestors, right? I think that's an important part of the conversation, that it's not us and them. Mm-hmm. A lot of people get stuck there when we start going on this path back, so to speak. Right. That all of our ancestors were indigenous somewhere at some point, and we've taken different paths, and, you know, some of us have kept certain threads in our family lineages, like food traditions, for example, or hunters, singers, artists. And so, you know, in looking, John Young is basically the, what I would call the bundle wrapper. He put all these things in a bundle.
And so for people who don't know who John Young is, quick description.
John Young founded the Wilderness Awareness School, and now he and I co-founded the H. Shields Institute together, and is a naturalist and author, What the Robin Knows, and has basically spent his whole life on this subject of reconnecting people to nature, mostly because of his childhood having a mentor who brought him into deep awareness of the natural world way beyond his peers, community, and professors at college. So he realized there's a lot of work to do in that area, and it's profoundly empowering and fun and spiritually meaningful. So he sees nature connection, as do I, as the pathway for rebooting culture.
Mm-hmm. All right, so
what are some elements of
what are these attributes that we may have had and lost, but the indigenous cultures can also sort of remind us of?
Well, there's so many. So I guess I was talking a little bit about him, that one of the things he did was he looked at a lot of indigenous cultures that had powerful nature connection and said, what other cultural elements did they have going on to create that? Because they didn't have classrooms. So what is their cultural classroom? We use school, but that's, you know, only 150 years old or so, right? So what did culture do to educate people before that? And it was all on the fly of actual real-time living. So storytelling was the main teaching tool for human beings. And you can find that in lots and lots of cultures, if not everyone. And I mean, storytelling, like, that was the mechanism for information.
That was the library?
Was the library. And then the people who were telling those stories were the librarians, otherwise known as the elders. And that's a whole huge subject of how do you have an elder? How do you create an elder? How do you find an elder? And that is a lifelong pursuit of inquiry and knowledge of place and knowledge of culture. So they are the internet, right? They are the library. There was no other books. And so you get this direct human transmission about large-scale things, small-scale things, and then they adjust them for you personally about what your next step is. I know when I tell people about, you ever wish you had an elder or a mentor or a teacher, they just, all that longing just unpacks.
Yeah.
When we talk about meaningfulness.
Yeah, I want to be seen is what that boils down to.
Yeah, and relevant. You know, it's not just a stranger seeing us.
Right.
It's somebody who says, hey, you're part of the fabric, and I know the fabric. I've got the map of this place, and this is how it looks. Holy cow. And so, you know, the other cultural elements that are super common are things like deep belonging to place and, you know, stages of initiation into that worldview. So, you know, human development is supposed to have nature connection all along the way. And there's sophisticated ways that cultures do that at 0, 3, 5, 9, 11, 13, 21, 40, 75. It's just an ongoing, nonstop relationship with the natural world through those human development stages. So whereas at 3, while you're learning to collect food, basically, and stay alive and learn about all the hazards, at 45, you're questing for a new vision. Mm-hmm. Because you've spiritually turned a corner and you're back out there again in a whole other level. Adolescent initiation in nature is totally common around the world, that we have to shift our identity from being egoic to being part of the collective. And that's a several year, if not 5 year, 10 year process, depending on what culture you're from. But it always begins with some kind of separation into the natural world. Think about that. We're going to help create our culture, and one of the necessary transitions that all humans go through, it's a doorway, mm-hmm. is alone in the natural world. That's like, we would think maybe college is that. If you're going to make it out into the world, if you're going to be part of this society, you're going to have to go to a good school.
Right.
They would never say you have to be alone in the woods for days on end.
Right.
Fasting. Mm-hmm. And coming back for something, with something. Like, there's an expectation that there's something that happens there, mm-hmm. you know, a bonding. And so that's a huge process. And what does that do for us in the long run, you know, in terms of keeping health and wellness in relationship to ourselves in the natural world, is that everybody's basically got their own direct responsibility to it. Mm-hmm. It's not a concept. Oh, there's lots of things like greeting customs. This is, you know, cultures have elaborate ways of meeting another and what happens during that process. Mm-hmm. That I remember reading about one. It came out of a conversation with a guy who was like Aldous Huxley. Is that his name? Aldous Huxley?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
His nephew or something like this. So mm-hmm. he was like a British kind of anthropologist guy. And he was in the Amazon and they were talking about how to make contact with these tribes and going through territories. And he described this ritual. And I was like, oh my God, this is a greeting custom. You know, because I have about 64 of these, what would you call them? Like frameworks, right? Mm-hmm. That are in general. So, you know, respect for elders would be one, awareness of the four directions, deep belonging to place, you know, initiation in nature. And this one's called greeting custom. And so the guy's, you know, coming into the territory and knocks on a hollow tree and hangs out there and won't cross until the other people come. And it could be half a day, a whole day, day uh-huh. and a half. And you can't violate that, mm-hmm. right? But once you do, the person comes and they start telling the story of what their journey was. Like, this is where it begins. And it's not about transaction of why are you here or what's going to happen when you come or what do I know about you? You know, it's like they start telling their story. Mm. And the other person repeated back what it is that they said verbatim. Mm-hmm. And I said, wow, that's kind of weird. What's that like, you know? So I said, experiment. So let's try that. So I say, so I drove over to my friend's house today. And you say,
tell me about that.
No, you actually repeat verbatim.
Oh, I have to do this verbatim?
Yeah.
So I drove over to my friend's house the other day.
And there was this weird thing happened at the mailbox. As I squeaked open the thing and I pulled in the letters into my hand. The spider bit me. So where are you right now as you're with me?
Like, I just got a spider bite.
Right? You're so with me. I thought, wow, that's genius. We don't even know about that. Like, that's where is that technique? You know, I'm not analyzing you. I'm not judging you. I'm not trying to figure you out. It's like I become bonded with you through that story. And I live it with you.
Interesting.
Yeah. So what is the purpose of that? You know, we're building a kind of bond together that we can go on a journey together before actually entering into the village.
Right. Now, just as a quick aside, when I was down in Peru very different culture. Noticed it right away. And of course, it's got a lot of indigenous people with indigenous stock. You know, they very clearly, but the whole culture was so different from anything I'd experienced. And there were clear, obvious signs. One to me was that all the people, after I gave a talk, they wanted to take their picture, and the women would come right up and put their bodies right up against, which in New England would have been a marriage proposal. Right? You know, but this was, they were very physical. And then I noticed the restaurants I went to, no TVs in any of them. And they had this languid sort of pace to the whole experience, you know, and on. And there was something I didn't quite get. And then I come home and a good friend of mine who's from Ecuador, she said, and this was completely just a random comment that came out, but suddenly it all crystallized for me. She said, in my culture, when you walk into a room, there could be 100 people at a party and you can't stop until you've greeted every single person.
Mm.
It's a full expectation. Like everybody in the room is tracking, oh, new person, they're going to greet me soon, right? So thinking about that, the culture I come from, it's totally common to go into a crowded situation and say hi to 3 people or 5 or not touch everybody in the room. But in another culture, they have a greeting custom that's so different. I'm like, oh, what would that be like? How different would that sense of togetherness, belonging, lack of isolation,
forced connection. Like you have to talk to people you don't like.
Yeah.
Right? I'm sure there's people they don't like.
Exactly.
You have to go and do the greeting. I've touched their hand, you know. Yeah. Yeah, probably, you know, there's a term called peacemaking. And it's important to mention here because I think the purpose of why cultural elements co-evolve with people in a society is for the purpose of health and wellness, peace, and happiness. I think that is their purpose ultimately. And so peacemaking is the proactive aspect of building connection. It's not conflict resolution after the fact. So if you think of it that way, you know, this greeting custom you're talking about is a form of peacemaking.
And so when you say peacemaking, what do you mean?
That their approaches for bonding and establishing connection with yourself and other people and the natural world ongoingly, proactively, like exercise.
And where does that come from? Which culture are we drawing from here?
Well, specifically, this is coming from the Haudenosaunee peacemaking. But if we use the term as a lens into why greeting customs, you know, that's a form of peacemaking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we can think of it as a concept too. And the classic greeting custom in the Haudenosaunee that we learned through Jake Swamp, who is a Mohawk chief, is gratitude. Is before, they called it the words before all else. So you know it's a greeting custom. It's the first thing that happens. And they're a huge theme of their culture is governance.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I like to think that different kind of tribal societies have different medicine or different gifts, specialties in a way, like Hawaiians, you know, are different that way. That, you know, they actually mentored and coached the founding fathers, you know, to develop, you know, democracy here in the United States. Most people don't know that.
Which is a super important story. And the Mohawks were part of the Iroquois Confederacy,
right?
Which was a confederacy of what, 7?
6.
6, six well, nations.
Originally 5.
5. But anyway, they were warring for hundreds of years, like really badly, terribly skirmishing, killing each other, doing all kinds of stuff. And then one person was born into one of those cultures.
Yeah.
And is identified as the man who happened to be a man who went forward and brought these principles forward that stitched together these warring nations into a single unified whole. And they had hundreds of years of experience with that.
Yeah.
And then shared that with the founding fathers who baked a lot of that into our Constitution.
Yes.
Not all of it, unfortunately.
a lot of it. But even the term we the people,
uh-huh.
That's how their Constitution starts. You know, so you can think that, oh, that sounds very native, doesn't it? We the people.
We the people,
We are the people. We the people. Mm-hmm. Like, they, you know, they didn't make that up, the colonists. And so, there's so much to say about all of that, but it shows us that early indigenous social technologies, you know, are the basis for, you know, how people survived here when they came here. I really feel there's a deep reciprocity that we owe and should be paying attention to with indigenous people here in this continent. And going forward, there's probably a ton more things that we've cast off thinking we were superior, right? If we go back into this story, for example, here and learning about gratitude, well, look at what they offered, you know, to the colonists. And then what did they get in return, right? So gratitude, they call this the Thanksgiving address. And they start with the earth and go up to the sky in that way. And they have things they say at each of these levels. So they will do this before any important governmental meeting. Anytime the chiefs get together and they have an important decision to make, they will first start with the words before all else, which I love, because what happens in that address is they see how they are interdependent with the natural world, all the ways in which our spirit is lifted by the sound of birds in the morning, how the clean water that we drink, you know, nourishes us and heals us, and how all the plants are the source of our medicine. Even today, Western medicine is sourced from plants. And of course, the people, all the ways in which people contribute to us every day that we don't even know are helping us to be alive. So that helps shift consciousness. And that's, so they have this consciousness shifting activity. And then they go into deliberating what's best for the people. I love that.
Right. What a great way to start. I'm reminded, probably little orthogonally, but there was this great piece in Brené Brown does all this work on vulnerability. And so she was doing does all this research, and she was asking people, there was something about the thing that prevents us from really connecting and being full of joy is what she calls impending joy, where people have the sense that if they open themselves up, they'll just get hurt, right? So they don't open up. That way they can't get hurt, right? So it's this sort of catch-22 piece. And gratitude's a way around that. And the interesting part that caught me was that she said when they did the research and they asked the question, like, you know, so your mother's died, you know, and she died suddenly and you didn't have a chance. And so if you could, what do you miss most? And they were expecting the resources going to say, oh, if we could just have one more walk down Grand Canyon at the best sunset ever, like some big grandiose moment. And people all reported that what they missed was, if I could just, my mother was a shitty texter. If I could just get one more goofy text from her where she doesn't quite get it, you know. It was the little moments that they were missing the most. And so what I hear you saying is that in this gratitude, like, we're taking things for granted, that life is actually happening in all of the little moments in all the time. And so this is a way to reconnect with the sacredness of all time, all moments, not the big ones, not, oh, the birth of my son, the graduation of my daughter.
Yeah,
you know, those things that we call big milestones, that the magic of life is happening right now.
Yeah.
And gratitude is a way for me to connect to right now.
Yep, that's part of it. We, you know, in the nature programs with the children, we introduced the Thanksgiving address, and we always basically did an inventory of what's happening right now in the moment. So as we went through the water and the birds and the trees and the animals and the plants, it would be basically trying to imagine deeply into what's happening right now with what we couldn't see and with what we could see. And so how are we thankful for this wind that's coming through today? You know, that's blowing things around, and, you know, the snowbank here in front of my house that I have to step over, and my car that's in the driveway. And of course it's maple syrup season, you know, and I'm just got to sit by the fire last night, and how I love that saved my life at the end of every winter. You know, I'm ritually tied to tapping the trees. So yeah, being present to what's actually happening is a powerful form of, what would you say, like, builds empathy and gratitude and appreciation. And I mean, that's probably the building blocks of having a meaningful life, right? You know, it opens you up, softens you.
Yeah. So some of the big missing elements here that I detect, it's certainly in my own life. And you mentioned it earlier, that idea of what happens when you ask people, what would it be like to have the mentor you always knew you wanted, and that opening that comes, that longing with the grief under there, right? Because there's some part of me that says, this should have been happening. This is like a should. I can feel it. Like, that's supposed to be there. And it's not.
Right? It's not your fault.
No, all right. So I want to get to this part of the conversation then, which is to say, okay, so we're people listening to this, and myself as well, on the edge of my seat here. So here we are. This is the reality of the culture we're in. And everybody who connects with my work is of the mind that this is, things are changing really, really rapidly, and maybe not for the better, and that there's absolutely an unsustainable trajectory that we're on yet we're all on it. So here we are caught in this avalanche. And the question is, how do we go about organize? What is it that we can do to build our own cultural and social capital in ways, given this is where we live? Hmm. What are the practices?
Well, I was thinking about this before he came over. What would be a good prescription without, you know, my personal story is so specific about what I did when I look back on it. But, you know, one simple way of looking at it is you have yourself to work with, and then the next ring out, which would be maybe your family or whoever's most close to you. And then the next ring out from that, which might be your geographic community. And if you think about those three things as nested with each other, then if you're doing some kind of personal connection work, bring your closest family into it with you. And then that group can do something in the community to affect the connection in the community. And maybe it's an assumption I'm making, but that you should look at connection in general. So how can I connect with myself? Mm-hmm. And so that might look like, what's my purpose? What are my specialties? You know, what are my gifts that I came into the world with? What are my challenges as a way of connecting with yourself too, right? I might have some parts of myself that are buried that I don't like. That's actually a really important form of connection that brings me into more wholeness. Like maybe what had that joy get put aside, you know, there might be some grief in there. So connecting with my sadness, is a powerful thing to do that brings you, into more wholeness. And I think it also helps you relate to other people better. So that's all work around you and connection. And then the next ring out is connecting with the immediate people around you. Who's your closest group that you're working with? And I know people feel a lot of isolation, and I've offered this before to other people, and sometimes they go straight to despair because they're like, I'm totally alone. Mm-hmm. And so they're like, I'm a ground zero. How do I do that? And I said, well, you know, I think in the past, culture used to take care of this for us. Having to greet everybody in the room, having to show up for ceremonies, having to show up to pick food with each other or whatever. And so now we do programs. And all the creative programs that are out there, I believe, are a substitute for what culture used to do for us, which is important, I think, to look at. So yeah, go take some programs. Go hang out with people in programs. Go find, you know, people who are teaching things there or creating connection at the program. But know that what you're wanting to do is to take that and move it into your life out of a program. That's the ultimate goal. Sometimes people get stuck in program to program to program because they love how it feels. Mm-hmm. But then they go through the cycle of despair on Monday morning. You know, it's like, where are all those people? I loved the people. You're my tribe. Let me get your phone number. We'll stay in touch. You know, but they're from Kentucky. You know, they flew to Rogue Conference Center, right, or whatever. So that's a little suggestion, right? But if you have a family, whatever you're doing to connect with yourself, I would try to stack functions and bring them all along with you. So people said, how do I get my children to enjoy being outside more? You know, I'm really worried about it. As a kid, I did stuff like that, and I just see them playing inside with computers and, you know, other toys and things. They just said, why don't you go outside? No, I don't feel like it. And I know statistically that that's bad. You know, I do the research. So what can you tell me to help them go outside? And I said, well, you're not going to like this, but the most powerful influence in your child's life is you.
Mm-hmm. I know where you're going with this.
Exactly. So I remember telling this to a guy, and he got upset with me. He's like, I did not want to hear that. You know, I'm a busy entrepreneur. I don't want to be spending time outside. I'm like, well, there you have it. You know, a lot of this stuff is not efficient. A lot of connecting with yourself and others in nature and building culture is not efficient according to our modern worldview. It's uncomfortable to slow down. Mm-hmm. It's a radical act to slow down. Mm-hmm. And the other general piece of advice, which is disturbing, is you're not going to be able to make this fit in the economy. That really bothers a lot of people. And that's one thing when I look back at my life, a lot of the things that I did that bring me immense joy and created lots of culture and community and meaningfulness to other people was not economically successful. And people say, well, you can do both. You can always have both. But at some point, you know, I'm going to show up for somebody because I think about a teenager who's having a hard time with their parents. And I've been building a relationship with them in a program, mm-hmm. right? But at some point, it's not a program anymore. And I'm going to spend some time with them, a week, once a week for a month, a whole summer, and invite them to come live with me. I'm going to take them on a trip with me. You know, I'm going to get to know them during this transition. I'm not getting paid for that. I can't find a way to get paid for that. So why would I do it? Mm-hmm. Well, if I died tomorrow, I'd say that was a meaningful week for me. Mm-hmm. You know, and I can see the joy that it's bringing this young person because that's the human blueprint. Adults are supposed to be showing up for teenagers. They're not supposed to figure this out on their own. Or aging people who become isolated. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a elder up the street from me named Eva. And it's funny because when I came to this community, I was looking for people to connect around community resilience. And they're like, well, the person who knows everybody around here is Eva, but she's really difficult person. You know, she's really challenging, you know. I got this kind of warning about Eva, you know, but she knows everybody. I'm like, oh, okay. And it was about a year later that I finally met her and I was like, she's amazing. I love her. And I think what they don't like her is she speaks the truth.
Oh, ouch.
She is a pistol. She's like Mae West meets like, you know, Joanna Macy meets Thich Nhat Hanh, you know. She's sharp and smart and funny and talks a mile a minute and like can see you in 5 seconds. And uh-huh. I love everything about her. And she has humongous common sense around people and social capital. In fact, she doesn't even make any money. She has no financial resources at all, I think. Mm-hmm. And yet, every time I go over there, she's moving goods. She's got like, here, take this. Go open my refrigerator. There's huge chicken in there. Take that with you. I'm like, I can't take your chicken. I'm going to have another one tomorrow. Just take that, please. Here, and this is its cutting board. This is a guy made this in a wheelchair, you know, and he's trying to, I bought 10 of them from him, you know. So take this cutting board and think of him. He's from Smead Woodcraft, you know. And, you know, take this over here. These socks, I can't use these socks anymore. I go, they're brand new. She goes, well, I can only use them when they're fresh because I have these heel spurs and they're really extra thick padding. So take them. You know? She's crazy. So I'm like, now I can't go over there without bringing her something.
Of course not.
So I bring her maple syrup, but I bring them in like 10 little jars mm-hmm. instead of like a big gallon or something, you know, because yep. I know she's just going to start moving it. Right. Uh-huh. So there's that. Right. But I know that she's really attuned. So, for example, my daughter has a new boyfriend first. And so I'm like, well, you should come over and we'll sit by the maple syrup fire together, you know, we'll mm-hmm. stoke the fire. And that's like, we've been doing that since she was zero. So she's like, oh, that sounds great. You know, uh-huh. I can introduce him to my dad through maple searing. That's just perfect.
There we go.
I go, oh, you know, it'd be really great. We should stop by Eva's when you come. You know, and I have introduced her to Eva multiple times throughout her childhood and many elders before that. So she's kind of got the drill, but she's probably different that way. You know how you like ruin your kids with like really weird habits, you know, and like you don't realize till you're in college and you try to explain to your friends that you have this weird habit and they're like, no, we don't do that. So spending time with elders and listening to their stories and knowing how to respect and bring them good questions is something she's been raised with. Mm-hmm. So when I suggested that, I think it just floated by her like, oh yeah, that's a good idea.
You're running this other script, right?
Yeah. So we get there and I get in the door first. I'm like, oh, Eva, so Lucia's bringing her friend here, a new boyfriend. So, you know, you should check him out.
You're counting on Eva's scanning function here?
I don't even have to. All I have to say is, I said, you should check him out. She's like, oh, okay. Oh, honey, how are you? You know, hug me. Oh, always hug on the side, heart to heart. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. Oh, you're so big. How are you doing? Oh, you look great. And she goes, so who do we have here? Puts out her hand, does the formal handshake, you know. And she's like, what's your name? Yeah. What's your last name? What are your parents' names? Oh, yeah, I know who they are. And then she, and she starts telling him everything about his parents that he didn't know. He's like, and he's like, wow, this is really crazy. This is, what a coincidence. You know, I'm like, no, what? Not a coincidence. So then we sit down on the couch and she just starts, you know, telling him, well, I know about your family. I know this about your family and that about your family, you know, and I respect this girl very, very much, you know. So you need to know that I'm watching you. Do you do anything active in the community? What do you do? She means like activism. You're like, what kind of things do you do in the community that stands up for people? You know? Then she went on to tell them this most amazing story in the 60s as a lesbian, open lesbian in Vermont. She joined the volunteer fire department.
Okay.
Which is like, imagine those guys.
Right.
And the whole point of the story is she wasn't going to take shit from them. And she was going to introduce them to a real person instead of a stereotype. So she's like, she's hardcore like that. And she got them to love them.
I'm just in awe that you outsourced the dad function. Got her to do all your hard work of probing this young man.
It was way better, actually. It was way better because, you know, I said to her, better you than me. Because she knew his family.
Yeah.
I don't know his family. She knew his family and she knew the history of his parents' divorce and the remarriage and the work they do in the world. And so she's just had to fill in a few more questions. That was about it. Whereas for me, I was like at ground zero with who this guy is and had all the other complications of being the dad. So I got to just enjoy all that. And then came over after. I was like, wow, that was pretty intense. Yeah. How was that for you? And she was like, he was like, hey, she's really cool.
Anyway. And he learned a few things about his family, so it was all good.
Exactly. No, he thought that was really amazing because she's just sharp. You know, she doesn't overdo it. But I guess the point of the story is like, you know, this is a relationship that I took time to build. Mm-hmm. There was no economy in this for me. Mm-hmm. And she teaches me all the time about who she is and how she makes social capital work. And she's wise beyond belief. Her life is extremely meaningful. Mm-hmm. Extremely meaningful. She makes zero money. Mm-hmm. You know how she bought her house? She went to the bank. She says, I would like to buy this house in Putney. It's right in the middle of everything. And I need $20,000. And they're like, well, you're going to have this much money in order to buy the house. And she said, well, if I had that much money, I wouldn't need to come to you now, would I? So she's like, to get the loan, right? So she's like, forget it. So she went to the community and she asked for $5 and $10 from every single person there that she could until she raised $20,000 and bought the house with cash.
Okay.
And she said, from now on, I owe the community everything. Mm-hmm. So that's what I do. That's my job. I give back to the community. They bought my house for me. That was 35 years ago and she's still doing it. I think that's a pretty good return on investment.
Absolutely.
For $5.
Best $5 ever.
You know what I mean? Like, she's done crazy things where she's just volunteered to go around to all the disabled elders in the community and bring them kindling for their wood stoves because they were throwing it out over here at the wood shop. So she just figured that out. Mm-hmm. Lots of things like that. Anyway, so I think that people get fearful around money as their sole survival safety mechanism. And if you can crack that open, which is what I'm attempting to do here, you can reach a lot of these needs that you're describing as somehow over here and economy is over here. I should be happy. I have all this money. The United States is one of the wealthiest places, but we're really miserable. Mm-hmm. In fact, you know, that whole gross happiness scale, what do they call that? The happiness index.
The happiness index
is inversely related to wealth. And so up to like $75,000 or something in this economy where we can have basic needs met. That you try to put a crack in that and spend time doing things that bring you joy and bring other people joy and build trust with people through experience. It's a kind of investment. So I was able to call on that on like in a moment's notice with Eva because of 5 years of relationship building with her, you know, and, which was great all along the way. But that for me, that was beyond important for me that happened. I had never had that moment with a boyfriend of my daughter before.
Mm-hmm.
It was great.
Mm-hmm.
So there's lots of other stories like that.
All right, we're going to draw this part to a close. This is part one. In part two, we're going to discuss all of these elements in much greater detail and go further beyond. So as we draw to a close here in part one, Mark, tell people how they can follow you more closely, your website, and whatever's going on that they should know about.
Okay, so my primary website is ifnaturallearning.com, which stands for Institute for Natural Learning. And there you'll see links to my We Are Nature Rising project, or you could go straight there, wearenaturerising.earth, and the business work, which is aconnectedleader.com. So they're all generally under this Institute for Natural Learning house, which is about really, I'm starting to organize it around three terms that interact with each other: nature, culture, and leadership. And so the leadership aspect is this aspect of self-development, mm-hmm. that I am an ongoing human developing, right?
Yep.
And I think that's my definition of being a leader and being involved in the change. Culture is everything we're talking about today, right? This whole context and being aware of how do we decouple from nature and how do we get back into right relationship with things and how do we keep an eye on that over 20-year times? And then nature, of course, which is our, you know, original who we are as human beings. We're a species, right? Nature and all the biological, psychological, social, ecological benefits of being intimately interrelated with it. So those three things can enter the business world, the education world, community life, family life, and it helps restore kind of the systems level, you know, of what we're experiencing.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a real pleasure.
Awesome. Yeah, I really enjoyed it.